Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right, and really excited to be joined by Paul Shirley, former NBA player and author of his newest book, Stories I Tell on Dates. What's up, Paul? How are you?
Good. I'm honored that someone thinks I'm getting it right.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, we have a low bar, bro, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not exactly... You could basically be 90% wrong as long as... You know what it is? As long as you're doing it in a cool way. That's more okay. Our criteria.
And you've been...
I think it's funny doing a bunch of book... I just got back from first book tour stop, which was in Phoenix, and now I'm headed out for a bunch more. And it is the ultimate example of like putting yourself in a echo chamber or a silo where you start to think that you're a genius because all these people are like, wow, you're so good at this. You forget that like 99.999% of the world is never going to read your book. And it's this very self-selective group that you've been talking to about.
So how do you design your life to make sure that you're only exposing yourself to those people that get that you're a genius? That's something that I work on a lot.
I think I need to do it a little more because I think most of my life I'm spent around people who don't think I'm a genius. So this is a nice little respite. Like I teach at it's a kind of a weird job. I teach at a prep school for the LAPD, but I'm technically an adjunct professor at West LA College. And those kids definitely don't think I'm a genius. So I get 60 bouts of you don't think I'm a genius for two people kindly saying that I am.
Well, what do all those other people know?
Yeah, what do they know? They're not geniuses.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Fuck out of here.
Now, you've been at this for a long time. Like, I remember when you were writing for ESPN.com, and, you know, you're actually one of the first people I started following on Twitter because of your music tweets. So it's like writing has been a big part of your identity as well as being obviously a professional athlete. Like, how have you transitioned those two worlds to kind of have the culmination in being in this book?
So I think it took me a long time to be able to articulate what was similar about writing and basketball. And that doesn't exactly answer your question because you're kind of talking about like, you know, some of the book has to do with sports and some of it does not. When I finished playing, I had been working on a novel that ended up going in the trash. And when it went into the trash, I had a little dark night of the soul here in LA where I realized like I just wasn't working hard enough at writing. And in the last 4 or 5 years have really buckled down on returning to the routine, the same sort of routine that worked in basketball. And I think that has been remarkably productive for my writing and that I have this book, I have the third draft of a next book, the third draft of a book after that already sort of in the works. And so it's, that I think helps explain to people like what's the connection between basketball and writing because people don't usually see that. Now, when it comes to like how do you sort of smash basketball with dating and memoir and writing about your childhood and all of that, I think I was lucky to have some really great editors and fellow writers who pushed me really hard to find the arc. Like there is an actual arc in this book of me realizing early on in the book, but later in my life, that I hadn't really had a girlfriend. So it also is this search for love that was elusive because I played professional basketball for so long.
So what, take us back. I mean, you did play professional basketball for quite some time. You have an illustrious career there. What you have a very interesting story about how specifically you got inspired to start writing. Maybe you could take us back a little bit and tell that story and connect it with your basketball career.
Yeah. So I, when I was in college, I played basketball at Iowa State. We were quite good. Not necessarily because of me, but most Pensley and Marcus Fizer, two guys who went on to get drafted in the first round. It was starting to become clear that I was going to get to be a pro. And I had, my junior or senior year, I had a friend of my brother's go overseas to play, and he was writing these hysterical emails about what he was going through playing in the second division in Spain. And I resolved that if I ever got to play professional basketball that I would do something similar. I don't really know why. I had always been a just voracious reader. I remember in college, my degree's in engineering, so I actually still enjoyed reading. Like most of my compatriots were just completely weighed down with reading, and I was doing math problems, so I was still excited about reading. At any rate, fast forward to first year out of school, go off to training camp with the LA Lakers, get cut as soon as they can cut me on the same day as Dennis Scott, who basketball aficionados will remember, which gave me a little bit of solace. Then went to Greece, and in Greece was just plopped down in pure madness. It was 2001, and the Greeks were switching to the Euro, which caused them no end of turmoil. And we were, you know, playing in Israel and Turkey and France and Poland. And it was just, you know, completely nutso for a guy from Kansas who'd never been out of the U.S. So I just started writing each week, like a little email about, you know, what was happening, what was going on. And I quickly discovered that that made me feel a lot less alone, because I would then get responses from people, which was nice. And then subsequently, if I made it funny, then people were more likely to respond. So it became this thing. Like I was, as my career was unfolding, each week I was sending out this little email update list, kind of like a, I don't know, proto blog, basically. People would ask me like, "Hey, really loving your stuff. Do you mind if we add this friend of mine to the list?" So by the end, I don't know, there were probably somewhere between 200 and 500 people like getting this weekly email update from me about what was going on in my basketball career.
What was the name of the team you played for in Greece?
Panionios.
Nice.
They are now, I believe, called Panionios 1891, because when I was in Greece, they only paid me half of what they owed me, which was not specific to them. Lots of teams did that. And we sued them, won the lawsuit, they appealed, we won the appeal, and then because so many teams were in trouble with their players, the Greek Ministry of Sport said, we'll forgive you guys all your debts as long as you promise never to do it again and change the names of your team. So Panionios became Panionios 1891, so that they didn't have to pay me and several other players.
That is so... Well, that's not great, but it's funny.
That fine it's financial management from the Greeks.
from the Greeks. It was kind of like a nice little, it turned out okay. I mean, I would rather have that $52,000 that they owe me, but I did get to write a kind of fun Wall Street Journal article about how I could sort of see the Greek crisis coming based on my experience of getting paid half of what I was owed while I was there.
Ah, the canary in the coal mine.
It must be somehow the Germans' fault, though. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to go back a little bit to what you were talking about with the routine of basketball as you started to develop, and that routine of being a writer. Like, can you go into a little bit more detail about what you discovered once you started taking your writing seriously? Because there's a story in the book where you describe, I believe you start to describe that process of taking basketball seriously, that you had put on weight, you went to like a shot doctor, someone who helped mm-hmm. you get this routine, and you kind of realized that this was the moment where things that you had been working on were now starting to become automatic to you. Your shot was falling, you developed certain moves and that played to your particular strength as a basketball player, and it sounds like, you know, from the moments I remember that, the things I remember from that story, that it seemed like this taking your writing seriously went through that same process. You know, can you walk us through a little bit about that?
Definitely. I it's been something that has been closer to my heart in the last maybe 2 years, largely because I run a workshop out here in LA, this writer's workshop called Writer's Block. And so I'm talking with writers a lot about their process, and I think that anytime we have to talk about our process or write about it or teach it, it helps us make sense of it. I think one of the things that's true about professional basketball players is that possibly because we hold them in this esteem of being cool or looking like they know what they're doing, we don't necessarily connect to how hard basketball players specifically work. If I told you about a gymnast, you'd be like, well, probably she got up super early and, you know, worked out for 4 hours a day and all of this stuff. But with basketball players, and some of this is probably a cross-cultural difficulty of understanding a lot of the time, it seems like, oh, well, they just do that because they're just naturally good at it, right? They're tall and they're talented and skilled, and so they play basketball. And so people don't necessarily understand that there's just hours and hours and hours of routine and like habit and all of this stuff that goes into it. So I've actually been talking a little more about that because I think I didn't necessarily understand that people didn't know that that was true. And so the more I've talked about that, the more I've started to connect to, like, writing is exactly the same. It's really, talent is so misused as a word. The only really talent I have for either basketball or writing is just getting up every day and making myself sit down or go to a court and do the same thing over and over again. For me in basketball, a lot of that had to do with figuring out that I didn't need to do as much and that I had figured out by the time I was 26, 27, 28, exactly what I needed to do in the gym. I'm starting to get there a little bit with writing, and a lot of what I need to do is just to do it every day. I've noticed that in basketball, if you took a day off, the day that you came back, you were rusty. So in a lot of cases, it was actually harder to take a day off because you knew that there was going to be this specter of rustiness waiting for you. Writing is very similar. I think a lot of people think they can just do it, you know, for 4 hours on every Saturday, and that'll make up for the fact that they're not doing it in between. It's actually so much more effective to just write for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour every day so that you pick up right where you were the day before and you don't lose that momentum.
Can we get into this? The book is Stories You Tell on Dates. You talked about sort of realizing during your basketball career that you hadn't been in sort of a relationship. I guess, first of all, maybe explain what that means. And then I think, you know, people have a lot of different ideas about how basketball players or other athletes, you know, that world, both in terms of, I guess, I think it was interesting the way you put it, because I think a lot of people, particularly men, think of it on the outside as like, well, there's a lot of temptation and a lot of partying and there's this and there's that. But you're basically kind of painting a little bit of a picture of like isolation, basically.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. When my first book came out, I got a TV agent said, why don't you come up with an idea for a TV show? And I said, hey, how about a wisecracking 12th man in the NBA? And he'll just say things about what it's like to play professional sports. And guys like, that's gold. We're doing that. So we sold this pilot to 20th Century Fox, and I moved to LA, and we got to make it. One of the problems with it, though, was that every television executive wanted being a professional athlete more glamorous than it actually is. And I wanted to impress upon the world how it's not as glamorous as people think it is. And that doesn't necessarily make for great TV. Like, I remember vividly, we were building this set for the team plane, and they were like, well, so we thought we'd put the bar over here and we'd get some like scantily clad waitresses. I'm like, we're not going to have a bar on the team plane. They're going from one pursuit of athletic excellence to another pursuit of athletic excellence, and everyone's tired and all they want to do is sleep and like not talk to anyone and get to the next place. And that is what I think humanizes it and makes it funny and or relatable, is that it's no different from any other business trip. It's just that everybody's like taller and richer, but that doesn't track with like the general population, because I think they want to believe that it's different, that if they had just done something different in their lives, that it would be glamour and glitz and, you know, hookers. In reality, I can't speak to everyone's
GGH
experience.
Glamour, glitz, hookers.
What I experienced personally was I had to work really, really hard to get to play college basketball. And then I had to work really, really hard to get to be a professional basketball player. And I wasn't going to screw that up with something frivolous along the way. I think another part of this is for every, Johnny Manziel, that's the football player's name. Like for every Johnny Manziel, there's another 10 guys who are just like punching in, getting their work done, going to bed at a reasonable time because they know like they've got, if you're a football player, 3 years to make your money. If you're a basketball player, you've got 10 years to make your money. Like, I think it's just, so, you know, if you're a football player, you have 3 years to make your money. If you're a basketball player, you have 10 years. And most guys are aware of that. So they take really good care of themselves. It's just that nobody knows about those guys. They're like the silent majority or whatever that Reagan term was.
Nixon voters of NBA players. That's pretty weird. It's not very
I think most guys are just like, you forget too, like, guys are just tired. Like, it's exhausting to be a professional athlete, and there's just not a lot of time for the hijinks that people want to believe there are. Now, there are some hijinks, of course, but I think it's like 10% of the guys are participating in 90% of the hijinks or something like that.
Got to be in that talented 10th.
I just love any use of the word hijinks. You know, I wanted to you know, ask you about sort of the personal nature of the stories. Obviously, it's a memoir. You're sharing these anecdotes, these stories about, you know, your dating experiences and love experiences and childhood and things that sometimes go right, sometimes that go wrong. Was there ever a moment where you felt that, you know, hesitant to share these stories, these ideas? And I think Michael alluded to it, this, you know, people have an idea of what athletes are like, right? That they're kind of closed off. There's a lot of bravado. It's not a field that's usually connected to emotional sharing. And particularly when it's not connected to their endeavor, right? So if you see an athlete, you know, crying about having won a game or lost a game, that's a context that we are comfortable with, you know, whereas in your book, there's a lot of crying, dude, and it's not connected to like the game. And so I was right. Really
what we're trying to say is, what the fuck?
Yeah, man, there's a lot of crying in there.
You could have just called it Stories I Tell About Crying.
Yeah.
That's actually a good title.
That could be the sequel.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you're right. That's one of the things I think I struggled with in basketball, was that I was always looking for that emotional connection with my teammates, with people who were willing to open up. And the truth is that you're in competition even with your teammates, and no one wants to show weakness. So I think it is, we're just sort of acculturated to this idea that athletes are macho than maybe they really are. And a lot of guys probably are more macho than I, as witnessed by all of the crying. I think I was looking for, you know, some kind of camaraderie with guys who were willing to like open up and all of that. But in truth, you're in competition constantly, even with your own teammates. And so people just aren't really willing to go to that space. Now when it comes to the writing of the book, I was lucky this time to have a really great editor who, anytime I basically started to make myself look cool or try to, she was very quick to point out, like, you know, you're not, this isn't you being vulnerable. This is you trying to make the reader feel a certain way. I have a friend of mine is a really great movie reviewer. His name's Vince Mancini. He works for UpRocks. And he recently wrote about how Murder on the Orient Express felt to him like it was sort of built for a huge audience. Like, that, you know, they try to do every of the tricks of movie making and storytelling, but then it doesn't work for anyone. Whereas Lady Bird, I think that's the Greta Gerwig movie, he talks about how like it's so personal and intense that then anyone can relate to it because it was, she really like nails this one experience. So then that becomes universal. And that resonated because I think what I've found with memoir writing or any great writing or good writing is that if you really dive into the personal of this, then there's a much greater chance that it becomes universal because other people see themselves or they see something about their own experience in that. Whereas if you're trying to control the audience or try to control how they feel, most of the time they can see right through that.
What was it like? And we were like a couple minutes away, but I'm curious about these different experiences of being in the NBA, and you know, you have like, I don't know, say you're on the Bucks right now and you're coming off of the bench and then you're like hanging out with Giannis. Like, what's the relationship between guys who are having like a more, you know, like workmanlike experience and then their relationship with a Giannis or obviously LeBron or a Steph Curry or, you know, these people that not only are making more money, but they are like pop culture icons in a different way. Then, you know, I guess in a similar way you could say it with actors, you know, it's like if you're, you know, not an extra, but like an established character actor or something, and you're coming in, but you're working with, you know, I don't know, De Niro or somebody who's this, you know, kind of global face, not even global name. What's that kind of dynamic like?
Well, it's an astute question. I think basketball does lend itself to, especially thanks to the way that David Stern decided he wanted to market the NBA a long time ago, it does lend itself to the individual more than lots of sports. So it is easy to see guys sort of take off from you. I was in Phoenix the year that Steve Nash won his first MVP. So it was the year that they were 62-20. And I kind of watched that actually happen. He had, you know, he was a good basketball player before that coming over from the Mavericks, but he was already 29 or 30 and there was questions about his back and all of that. So nobody thought this guy's going to be an MVP. I think a lot of it happens because there's so much attention paid to them that it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where they change. It changes their personality just to go through that. So I think a lot of times those guys want to just be able to hang out with the rest of the dudes on the team and maybe start with the best of intentions of like, this is, I'm just like that other guy. But then there's 30 guys, 30 reporters huddled around their locker after the game. And then it becomes impossible for them to see themselves in that way. And then the rest of the team kind of gets left behind.
Right. So what are the next moves? Like, there's more book writing ahead, you're teaching. Is there any other, or is there, now.
I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, well, please could you.
You guys caught me on my last day.
Oh, you couldn't do a gap after maybe do a couple of other media appearances so it could be blamed on other hosts?
Yeah.
Well, think about how famous this episode is going to be, guys. It's like awesome.
I don't know. I mean, it might pop on Twitter for a couple of days.
But and then it'll be over.
Yeah, that'll be over. We need to do something more durable.
We're in the long tail of this.
Yeah, if you want to make news, you should threaten to kill somebody or something. That might have... That might be more durable.
It, or get into like a beef with Cardi B or something.
Yeah, get into a beef with Cardi B. You have a problem with her?
Oh, shit. Yeah, no. I barely know who that is. I'm becoming well, there, the old
sounds
man.
Like beef to me.
The beef is, yeah, I don't know who you are.
You know, I was thinking this might be a moment, even just in the last couple of years, and I don't know when you were working on your TV show last, but I feel like the kind of cultural moment for the sports team having a kind of blue-collar experience and maybe some of the comedy around that, I feel like might be more ripe right now. As like Entourage doesn't age well and Ballers sucks. Maybe there's a space for some type of like, you know, you're just on the fucking plane trying to, you know, get your proper carb protein ratios before you play another game in Cleveland and you're
trying
just tired.
Trying not to die with a blown spleen and all that good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I think every time I think about these shows, my brain just goes back to baseball. Like, I think there's a reason that there are so many good baseball movies. There's something about baseball that it's easier for the everyman to relate to. Like, I think that's one of the biggest problems we had with our TV show was that it's really difficult to find people who look like credible professional basketball players. It's hard to even find guys who look like minor league basketball players, but you can find dudes who look like baseball players without too much of a stretch. So maybe someday I'll write a great baseball TV show. I don't know.
I was just watching Moneyball, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
What's that?
I said I was just watching Moneyball again, and I totally agree with you. I think it's like one of Brad Pitt's best performances in the past few years.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, there are just so many great baseball. I think that's why Eastbound and Down worked, right? Like, it's, you're like, I don't know. Okay, I guess sorry, there's an ice cream truck outside my house, and that just completely ruined my train of thought. But I was like, David Ortiz doesn't look like a highly conditioned athlete, right? So I could imagine some dude from down the road, like, playing Major League Baseball, kind of.
No, that's exactly. Well, appreciate it. The book is Stories I Tell on Dates. Thank you so much, man.
This Thank you, great, guys. Man. I've been, as Phil mentioned, we've been Twitter friends for years and years and years. It feels like we go back to when Twitter was fun.
Yes, exactly. Well, exactly.
It might even be before I even started my Twitter account. Well, that was, I hope we follow each other soon, Paul.
That was one of we the will. Funny things about it. Like, you always used to have this, your random play of the day or whatever you called it. Like, whatever the first song you played on your iPod, you posted mm-hmm. that on yeah. Twitter.
yeah. It was a long-running semi-gag. And then nobody cares about that because everybody has Spotify. So it doesn't matter anymore.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just followed you. Paul Shirley. Everybody check him out. The book is Stories I Tell on Dates. Really appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much.
This is great, man. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.